Hey guys, it's me, Jeremiah. I just want to let you know that today the audio quality is not as good. I recorded over Google Hangouts for the first time because it was an interview format. So there are some audio issues, and not that this is the best quality audio podcast that you listen to, but there is usually a certain level of quality that I meet and that at least I've come to expect. And if you expect that level of audio quality today, you will be very disappointed. But I think that the information is interesting, especially if you're interested in history, and especially if you're interested in the history of Baptist anarchists in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in the 17th century that the interview today is about. So, despite the less than ideal audio, I hope you enjoy. Thanks for listening. We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Hey guys, I'm Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy. In case you're wondering what that is, it is a podcast for followers of Jesus who hate roads. That's pretty much the best description of it. And today is a weird episode, a special episode, if you will. I am not alone because God is always with me. And in addition to that, I have a guest on the show today to talk about Baptist anarchists of the 17th century in Rhode Island. Lots of adjectives on that one. And as you can tell from the expression in my voice, I'm very excited to talk to him. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you the foremost expert on these Baptist anarchists in the world, Kenny Cochran. You want to say hi?
Well, thank you for having me. I wouldn't exactly call myself an expert, but...
Well, I try to be somewhat dishonest with my listeners, so I like to mislead them. No, he approached me a few weeks ago mentioning some ideas about talking about this group in Rhode Island, which to me sounded interesting and I'd never heard about them before. Basically, his expertise is that he's read some books on them. That's how you can tell how popular this particular podcast is that my experts are people who have read some books. So let's get to it. Can you just give us like a basic summary of who these people are, when they got started in Rhode Island, and how that all came about?
Well, it's actually a little bit of an interesting story. In fact, if you were to take all the people involved and turn it into a movie, you'd probably wind up with a PBS series that spanned a couple of a couple of years maybe. It's basically it starts with. Well, the majority of it starts with a single person, a woman by the name of Anne Hutchinson.
Okay.
She migrated to the Massachusetts Bay Colony in, She migrated to the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1634.
1634, okay.
Yeah, she had grown up in Alford, Lincolnshire, England, and she was the daughter of a minister named Francis Marbury. Francis Marbury had actually been imprisoned for a few years for heresy against the Church of England. So she grew up in a house.
What was his heresy? Do you know?
He was one of the early Puritans.
Okay.
And spoke out against the lack of religious training for clerics in the Anglican Church. And because of this, he wound up getting sent to prison for about 2 years.
For complaining about the lack of religious training. That's quite an authoritarian system. Man, you get that trained into people with religion and the state.
So so she was born in Marbury in Lincolnshire, England. And let's see, she her father moved to London after he had been restored to the clergy after his imprisonment. He moved to London in about 1605, and the whole Marbury family went with him. That's where Anne met her future husband, William Hutchinson, who was a merchant that he coincidentally had grown up in the same small town that Anne Marbury had grown up in.
Oh, wow. Did they know each other before then, or...?
They had known each other, not childhood friends, but they were acquaintances. So they wound up forming a relationship and falling in love and getting married. And then a few years later, they wound up moving back to their hometown where they started raising a family.
Okay.
So that was about 1612. About that same time, a minister by the name of John Cotton moved to Boston, Lincolnshire, England, which was about 20 miles away from Alford, Lincolnshire, England, where he began his ministry. John Cotton had some pretty interesting ideas, at least for the time. He became a proponent of what's known as free grace theology, which it basically boils down to we are saved by grace and faith and not by works, which to most modern day people, that sounds pretty straightforward, but to the Church of England, which had its roots originally in the Catholic Church, and was basically a spinoff of the Catholic Church in protest to the Catholic Church, it still maintained a lot of the religious ceremony and salvation through works that that went along with the Catholic Church.
When I hear that stuff, I think the salvation by works is in some ways a way of maintaining some sort of authoritarian control over people or some sort of hierarchy position over people rather than the free grace, which in my mind, at least from what I've experienced in my life, free grace makes it more difficult to exercise that sort of control over people.
Yes, I would agree with that as well. John Cotton, let's see, he practiced his ministry for a pretty good while, from about the time when he arrived in Boston, Lincolnshire, England, till about 1633. That's almost 20 years he practiced in England, and he had a reputation for being very conciliatory, soft-spoken, which is one of the main reasons why he was able to practice so long in the climate where people were being imprisoned and persecuted for having beliefs that didn't match the religious orthodoxy.
So gentleness kept him free from some persecution.
Yeah, he had a reputation for being a very likable and agreeable person. Mm. He made friends with the Anglican clergy, and that helped protect him from some of the problems that other ministers experienced when they spoke out against the church. But by 1633, it had gotten to the point where the powers that be were dead set on squashing Puritanism and returning the church to its tried and true doctrine. So at that point, John decided that the gig was up and it was time for a change of scenery. So he wound up marching to Boston, Massachusetts, to the newly established, well, I guess it wasn't really new at that point. It had been running pretty strong for a number of years.
Yeah, historically.
Well, the Hutchinson family, during this time where he was preaching in England, had grown very fond of him, and they had grown so fond, in fact, that within a year of his departure, they decided to move to Boston, Massachusetts as well. So they followed on another ship about a year later. One of their sons actually was on the same ship as John Cotton. He was already an adult, so he went with John Cotton to the new to New England. About 2 years after the Hutchinson family moved to Boston, Anne Hutchinson got a reputation for being a very outspoken woman. She was very learned because she had grown up in the house of a minister, and she had several ideas that were quite controversial to the Puritans of Boston, of the entire Massachusetts Bay Colony.
How controversial was it just for her to be talking out as a woman? Were there people who even accepted that?
She was very careful about how she approached that. It was commonplace for the Puritan women to lead Bible studies in their house, where they would teach other women. That was considered a proper role for a woman to have at that time. So they were, they were allowed to teach other women. So she would hold these Bible studies in her house, and she would criticize the messages of the ministers. This gained her quite a following and caused a lot of discord between husbands and wives within the colony. But it also caught the attention of a number of ministers. Now, she was also a follower of John Cotton's free grace theology. So she was very outspoken about the Puritan idea that you had to perform good works before you could receive salvation, as a kind of preparation for the Holy Spirit to indwell you. And she spoke out against that very adamantly. It even got to the point when she gained the attention of the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony at the time, a man by the name of Vane, I believe. And he actually attended her Bible studies that were supposed to be for women.
Okay.
And so did a minister by the name of Roger Williams, who winds up playing a bigger part in this whole thing. This what happened next was wound up being called the Antinomian controversy. An antinomian is one that takes the principle of salvation by faith and divine grace to the point of asserting that the saved are not bound to follow the law of Moses. Antinomian literally means against law. She wound up causing such a controversy that there was a shift of power within the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Governor Vane was up for re-election and wound up losing to Winthrop, who was not a fan of the Boston Church or Ann Hutchinson in general. Upon taking power, he began dismissing judges that were sympathetic to John Cotton and Ann Hutchinson, and they eventually, it came to a head, and they actually tried Ann Hutchinson and one other minister, or I should say one minister, with they couldn't charge Ann Hutchinson with treason, but they charged the minister with treason. She had never actually spoken out against the government.
Okay.
She had only made her religious views known, but she had never actually spoken out against the government. Minister, however, his name escapes me at the moment, but he had actually spoken out against the government, so they charged him with treason. The Church of Boston signed a petition for his release, and the way things wound up, they actually used the names on that petition to dismiss other government officials that had signed the petition. So they stacked the deck against this minister as well as Ann Hutchinson.
That's super. It's one of the millions of great examples throughout history of why it is so stupid to have a coercive monopoly in charge of justice and law. You know, just to have the governor be able to pick the judges and stack the deck, like you say, doesn't lead to justice, that's for sure.
So during her trial, Ann Hutchinson was repeatedly asked a series of questions. They probed her for her theological views. She was actually tried twice. Once was a civil trial, and the second was a religious trial where she was actually tried by the church, the established church. It's during her first trial, she refuted most of the arguments against her, and she had at least three witnesses that came forward and testified on her behalf. One of them was John Cotton, who, in his usual conciliatory way, he tried to sway the court that what they thought she had said wasn't what she had actually said, to try to smooth things over.
Yeah.
But in the end, she kind of derailed his arguments.
She derailed John Cotton's arguments?
Yeah. She, okay. Her final statement, she actually did something a little controversial. She claimed that God had given her direct knowledge of what would happen to the Massachusetts Bay Colony if they continued with their Inquisition.
Yeah.
She,
interesting.
In her own words, she said, "If you go on in this course, you begin, you will bring a curse upon you and your posterity, and the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it." And that was pretty much the straw that broke the camel's back. They stopped all questioning after that, and found her guilty. And John Cotton tried to speak up for her one last time, but they silenced him and told him to mind his own business.
Yeah, interesting.
So Governor Winthrop at the time then read an order aloud, and I'll just go ahead and quote it. It said, "Mrs. Hutchinson, the sentence of the court you hear is that you are banished from out of our jurisdiction as being a woman not fit for our society, and are to be imprisoned until the court shall send you away." And that is exactly what they did. They didn't really have a prison at the time, so they wound up confining her to the home of another resident.
Okay.
She was She was not allowed to see her husband or her children. Jeez. For several months. Eventually, they did finally banish her. And that was sometime in the spring. She was only being held about 2 miles away from her family, but the winter made it difficult for any of them to come and see her. After her sentencing, the governor issued a decree that began confiscating guns, pistols, swords, powder, shot, and match from anyone that had supported her.
Oh.
And if they did not relinquish these items, they were fined £10 for every instance of refusal. So, sometime in the spring, they held the second trial, and it didn't really go any different than the first. Most of the transcripts of the first and second trial are available to read, because she had such an impact on the people that were trying her that they wrote it down in their personal journals.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, but about, I guess it was just by 1638, she was being banished. And a number of people from Boston that were her strongest supporters, they had also been stripped of their rights to vote in elections. They'd been stripped of the rights to serve in a position of authority. So they were kind of wondering what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
They got together and decided to move to Rhode Island. They formed a compact known as the Portsmouth Compact, and they acquired some land. One of Hutchinson's supporters was a man named William Coddington, who was a wealthy aristocrat. He financed the purchase of a large tract of land from the Indians in Rhode Island.
Okay.
And about a year later, a number of these supporters of Hutchinson founded the town of Newport. Founded the town of Portsmouth.
Portsmouth Compact.
Things did not go quite as they had expected. It turns out that William Coddington kind of got a little big in the head, and because all the land was in his name, he started running the town as if it were his own personal feudal kingdom.
Yeah, dictator. All right.
So about a year after they had moved, he wound up being driven out of town by the rest of the townsfolk. And
he was driven off his own land?
He was driven off of his own land.
Okay.
And he went to a neighboring area and founded a town called Newport. It was these events, her own trials, as well as the events that happened in Portsmouth after arriving, that convinced Anne Hutchinson that government was not something that should be supported at all.
Like many of us, she experienced a disenchantment with people ruling over other people and saw that in practice it didn't work out so well.
That's cool. And after Coddington had been forcibly terminated, I guess you could say, from his position in Portsmouth, her husband wound up becoming the magistrate of Portsmouth. But by the end of 1640, only a year after Coddington had left, she convinced her husband to step down as magistrate by telling him that she did not feel that Christians needed a government in order to live their lives. She said that the Holy Spirit was the only justification that anyone needed. And I guess she was pretty convincing because he stepped down.
That statement was a little confusing to me, that the Holy Spirit was the only justification people needed. Is that meaning like guidance or direction or?
Basically, she took the free grace theology to its ultimate conclusion and decided that not only did Christians not need the law of Moses, but they didn't need any law at all, that the Holy Spirit guided them, and that they were capable of living a moral life without laws to govern them.
Cool.
So, unfortunately, this didn't turn out well for Anne Hutchinson. Her husband wound up dying a year after he stepped down. And he stayed on for another year after his death, but she kind of grew disenchanted with the way things were going in Portsmouth. And she wound up moving with, I forget how many of her children were still living with her at the time, but she wound up moving to an area near the Dutch colony in, I guess it was New Amsterdam at the time. What's now the Bronx area of New York.
Wow.
But while she was there, the Dutch were having problems with the local Indian population. It was kind of interesting. The Indians would give warning when they were about to raid the area to give everyone a chance to flee. She chose
just
not
to take their stuff. Is that what they were doing, or?
I don't really know all the details, but I think that they would basically come and ransack the homesteads and destroy things and take whatever they could get their hands on. And it was caused because this whole thing was kind of secondary to this particular story. But Hutchinson leave, even though she had been given fair warning. And when the Indians arrived, they were not expecting anyone to be there. But they decided to do what they had intended to do, and they wound up killing Anne Hutchinson as well as most of her children. And that was pretty much the end of her story. Back in Rhode Island, however, there was a series of things that happened. One thing that happened was that the Coddingtons' new establishment of Newport wound up reconciling with Portsmouth, and they wound up combining into a single colony. And over time, there was two other small towns within Rhode Island that also joined into this colony, and that's when they officially became a colony of Rhode Island.
So four colonies kind of combined to become the Rhode Island colony.
They had some issues with the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which started expanding its territory.
Okay.
And they started feeling threatened by this. So Roger Williams, who basically became the first president of the colony, took a trip to England to try to secure political support for the colony of Rhode Island and to find a way of stopping Massachusetts Bay from expanding its territory. Upon returning to the Rhode Island colony, he retired from public life. He had managed to accomplish what he set out to, and the Massachusetts Bay Colony was kind of forced by the English. I guess it wasn't crown at the time because it was under Cromwell's leadership. I guess he was the Lord Protector of England, because they had during all this going on in the New World, England had gone through a civil war and wound up deposing the king at the time. So it was actually under protection of the king. It was under protection of the Lord Protector, Cromwell, and Parliament. But back in the New World, after he returned, he retired from public life. He continued preaching and teaching. He wrote several pamphlets that were influential. Roger Williams was a bit of a firebrand when it came to his theology. He took free grace theology and kicked it up a notch. And he's probably considered the first libertarian, the first libertarian in general in the New World.
Did he actually have a term to describe himself in that sense, or is this just looking back and applying it to him? Like, did he distinguish himself in any way?
Described himself as libertarian. The term didn't really originate yet, but what is interesting is that this his philosophy and his theology were very much based on natural rights, but it was still another half century before John Locke wrote his thesis on the nature of government. And really laid out the foundation of what natural rights are.
Yeah.
So he was kind of ahead of his time in that sense. But
cool.
Something prompted him to Roger Williams to step out of his private life and return to politics. There was threats from Native American populations that were threatening several of the colonies. And he wound up becoming governor of Rhode Island. And as governor, he oversaw the passage of a forced conscription bill that was very controversial. And it seemed very out of character for him, but some of the things that happened while he had been in England seems to have changed his mind about the idea of having such liberty. He saw while he was in England, he saw that the Church of England had been won over by Puritan thought and by Calvinism, and was doing the exact same thing that the previous group of power in power had done. They were, arresting people for heresy. They were trying to force everyone to abide by a whole new set of rules. And I think this kind of, I don't know, it disenchanted him from the whole idea of that, I'm not really sure where I'm going with that train of thought. Yeah.
It's the idea about liberty.
Yeah, he. But when he took power in Rhode Island, a lot of the beliefs that he had held when he wasn't in power suddenly fell by the wayside, and he found himself doing things that any other statist would wind up doing. He never did declare himself to be an anarchist. He always believed that there was a need for government. So that put him at odds with Anne Hutchinson, for one, and with a large group of Quakers and Baptists that were located in Rhode Island.
Okay.
It was actually the Conscription Act that kind of pushed the Baptist over the edge.
I'm sorry, what year was the Conscription Act?
I was not able to locate the exact
date
of the act, but it happened sometime in the 1650s.
Okay.
But there was a large population of Baptists that lived in the Portsmouth area, and they became very angry about this Conscription Act. They felt it was a violation of their natural rights. It was a violation. They went so far as to call it a violation of Christianity. And they started publishing pamphlets calling government itself a violation of Christianity.
Huh. Interesting.
And
did they use the term natural rights as well?
No, they never really called it natural rights. I believe they referred to it as God-given rights.
Okay. Same thing, pretty much, functionally.
Pretty much the same. But they circulated a petition and charged, well, here, I'll just read the exact quote.
Okay,
charged it was blood guiltless and against the rule of the gospel to execute judgment upon transgressors against the private or public weal. In short, government itself was anti-Christian. This was basically, it caused a crisis within the government of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And the Baptists actually wound up rising in rebellion against the Williams government. But Williams gathered what forces he could and put them down by force. And that was pretty much the end. They weren't, as far as I know, they weren't massacred or executed for treason, but they were put down forcefully and they never rose up again. And over time, the anarchism of the Baptists in Rhode Island faded.
Yeah. That's a long story. Cool. And were the Quakers already sort of anarchists, or?
Yes, the Quakers were pacifists.
Right.
The Baptists claimed they were pacifists too, but then again, they did rise up.
Violent rebellion.
I'm not sure what Baptists they really were. But the Quakers were pacifists, and there was actually some exceptions made in some of the laws that compelled military service that were made for the Quakers. So the Quakers never did rise up in rebellion quite the same way the Baptists did.
Yeah. It did. I don't know what you know, but you said that anarchism kind of faded with the Baptists. Did it continue with the Quakers? I don't know much about them. Here's what I know. A lot of Quakers are anarchists right now. I'm not sure if that's a universal thing or if that strain has remained kind of consistent throughout Quaker history, at least a line of it, to make it into today, or if it's just a new uprising that we're seeing.
I haven't really studied the history of the Quakers. I'm a Baptist myself. I grew up in a Baptist church, and what fascinated me about this was that I didn't realize that there was actually anarchist Baptists at all.
Yeah.
Until I was actually pointed to this by finding out about Anne Hutchinson, who is credited as being the first American anarchist.
Okay.
Makes sense. From reading a Wikipedia article about her, I found out that there was this group of anarchist Baptists, and then I started following all the links.
Yeah.
And that took me down the rabbit trail. And then I went and found a couple books on Anne Hutchinson to get a little more detail on her. There unfortunately aren't any books that I could find on the anarchists of Rhode Island themselves. They were kind of a flash in the pan because their influence
like
a few years.
So how did you just found out about Anne Hutchinson? How did you find out about her originally?
I saw a quote from Anne Hutchinson.
Okay.
And that prompted me to find out more about her because it the quote was something very anarchist. I was surprised that, it was an old English, and it surprised me that something that old would speak about anarchism without using the word anarchist. So that got me interested in looking into her life. And that's when I discovered that she had actually inspired this whole of Baptists to become anarchists. So,
yeah. That and government doing what they do, evil things. Do you know more about the kind of philosophical and theological foundation for their beliefs? Did they, obviously, like you said, they were kind of a flash in the pan, and I think it takes a while to sort of develop more complex theology around that, but was there more to it than what do we get? We have the extent of free grace, the Holy Spirit, who was all that was needed for guidance, and Christians don't need laws. And then the Baptists said that government itself was anti-Christian because it violated God-given rights. But did they have more of a biblical, scriptural basis for that you know of?
No more than some of the same scriptures you've already touched on in your podcasts. They did have access to the Bible because the Gutenberg printing press had been invented years and years before this.
Yep.
So they had access to several different translations of the Bible in English at their disposal. So they, that the Gutenberg press was probably the one thing that spread Protestant sects of religious belief more than anything else, because it made it far easier for people to read the Bible for themselves and to form their own opinions. I do know one other thing that came out of not necessarily the Baptist anarchists, but the free grace theology.
Yeah.
And that is the idea of congregationalism. The idea that a local church body should not be submissive to some hierarchical structure of church.
Interesting.
That's something that you see throughout a lot of Protestant denominations, even today. I mean, I'm pretty sure that almost all Baptist churches are independent of one another. They have higher authority than the pastor, and in many cases, the pastor himself says, "I am not an authority. I am a shepherd only." So that in and of itself was a drastic change from Catholicism, from the Anglican Church, from even the Protestant Protestant movement of Martin Luther.
Yeah, and most modern religions, really.
Yeah, and
different than that, the hierarchical structure.
Yeah, so I've been a Baptist my whole life, and I'm pretty familiar with how Baptist churches operate, and there is some loose associations. There's a Southern Baptist Convention, but participation is voluntary and no church is required to be a member of it. And any church can leave anytime they want. So it's more like a voluntary association than it is a hierarchy.
Yeah. Even from what I've seen, even church plants from the SBC can have to choose that they actually want to be a part of the Southern Baptist, or else, even though the Southern Baptist convention, it's a convention, right? Not a conference.
Yeah, it's a convention.
Okay. Even though there's also a local one here, Baptist General Conference, or at least that's what it used to be called. But even when they invest money and resources into starting new churches, they still do not require that the churches remain a part of the convention, which is kind of cool. Like you're saying, definitely focusing on the voluntary nature of the associations and giving local power to the local churches and allowing local expressions of the body of Christ to be as different as they want to, basically, or close to. I am curious, just for myself, you said that they use some of the same scriptures that I used. Do you remember what any of them were that they actually used specifically to back the anarchist ideology?
I'm not entirely certain of the exact scriptures. I'd have to do some more research, but I can certainly make available any of the notes that I've taken on the matter and make them available to you for links in your podcast, though.
Yeah, that'd be great if you want to send me an email about that stuff. I think you've covered a lot. It's very, very interesting the way that stuff came about, because I, like you, I've never heard of such a thing as Baptist anarchists before the U.S. even became a nation. It's too bad they didn't catch on a little more. Who knows where we'd be. One thing, I'm curious as to your analysis of this. Do you think as modern anarchists, there's anything we can learn from them and from their story that would be helpful to us?
Well, I think one thing that we can learn is that armed uprising isn't all that effective at getting your goals. So,
yeah,
it certainly didn't work for them. And I mean, you can look at other examples of anarchists trying to resort to using violence to achieve political means, and none of them have been very successful.
Yeah, and really, I think anyone using violence to achieve an overthrow of the government for whatever their reasons happen to be often ends up backfiring on them. Even with the American Revolution, you have an overthrowing of the government for freedom, and then you have a steady increase in restricting freedom. Or you overthrow the government to institute a communist regime, and it turns out millions of people die and starve and are murdered. It seems that violent overthrows of government, whatever their purpose, whether it's to end the state or to institute a different one for some sort of justice with people, always ends up being negative eventually for the population as a whole. Although it does work out pretty well for those in power, or tends to. Yeah, I do appreciate that most anarchists I know are against a violent uprising to try to overthrow the government, and recognize how futile that would be, and that such a thing is completely unnecessary when we get enough people who are willing to be just ethical human beings at the most basic of levels. It's not even really an admirable level of ethics that we ask people to strive for. It's just, don't hurt other people. Don't take their stuff. It's not even ethically impressive. It would just be such a wonderful world if more people held to those principles consistently.
It's really basically just restating the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So
yeah, even they talk about, I can't remember, but there's variations of the golden rule. I don't know if you're familiar with this in different teachings that, like by Buddha and stuff, which are, I believe they paint it in the negative, which is don't do unto others what you wouldn't want them to do unto you. Whereas the Christian golden rule asks a little bit more assertiveness in the process, like physically, like actually do actions to love people, do actions to care for others, as opposed to just don't do anything to someone that's bad, which is the other version. But I think that anarchism asks for less than even the golden rule, although certainly the golden rule inevitably leads to anarchism, which I think is the point you were trying to make making.
There is one other instance of anarchism. Well, not really anarchism, but anarchy in the early American colonies.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania was actually without an established government for, I believe, about a period of 2 years. It had something to do with the fact that William Penn had gone back to England, and the people of Pennsylvania rejected the person that he had appointed governor.
Oh, so they just went without for a while.
They just went without a government for about 2 years, I think.
Interesting. Did that not go well, or did they just...
No, everything just kept turning along. People were consumed with their own daily lives, and Pennsylvania was fairly religious, and people held themselves to a high moral standard, so there wasn't a whole lot of crime or need for punishment of any kind. So
and that is the nice part about having so much religious, is there's a lot of community around that, and you have a lot of people who you know mutually that are people you respect and admire, who you trust, and hopefully multiple parties trust to resolve disputes for you in case some arise without having to waste the time and energy going to court to do any sort of dispute resolution.
Yeah. But I think I'm going to have to cut this podcast a little short for myself. I'm still at work.
Still at work. No, that's great. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your research, and for putting all this together and sharing this with me. It's interesting, and it's nice that I didn't have to read anything on my own. And at some point, if you want to send me some email links to the information that you gave, that'd be great.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thanks a lot, Kenny. I will see you later on the internet somewhere.
All right. Thank
you. Have a good night, man.
Bye.
When I finished my conversation with Kenny, I also forgot to give you guys some necessary information regarding him. He didn't ask me to plug anything, so you won't get that. But if you would like to learn more information, I will have links available on the website www.christianarchy.net. That's christianarchy.net. And then to find the episode very quickly, just search 44 in the search box, and this episode should pop right up, and you'll have links available to look at more information. And if you have anything that you think would be interesting related to anarchy that you know a bunch about and would like to talk about, you can go ahead and send me an email at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. As you can see, I am not someone that holds on to my projects with tight fists. I am open and willing to let other people share their thoughts too, if I think that they might make for an interesting and productive conversation, which contributes to and adds to the main themes of this podcast. So, I hadn't really thought about it before, but in case you're someone that has something you'd like to share, contact me and let me know, and I'll see what I think about it. All right. I love you guys. Grace and peace, and goodbye.